Awesome to welcome LA Sparks assistant coach Mike Neighbors to the basketball podcast. Mike Neighbors is an assistant coach for the Los Angeles Sparks, joining the WNBA franchise in the 2025 season after a highly successful collegiate career coaching. He previously served as the head women's basketball coach at Washington from 2013 to 2017 and Arkansas from 2017 to 2025, compiling a 246 and 155 career record across 12 Division I seasons. At Washington, Neighbors led the Huskies to a 2016 NCAA Final Four and multiple NCAA tournament runs. He later guided Arkansas to its most successful eight-year stretch in program history, including six postseason appearances and marquee wins over top five opponents. Neighbors has earned national recognition, including being named Werner Later Naismith National Coach of the Year semifinalist in 2017. In 2025, Neighbors transitioned to the WNBA, joining the LA Sparks coaching staff, bringing more than 30 years of coaching experience.
Do you know which lineups and player combinations are the most productive? Hoopsalytics has the most comprehensive lineup analysis system available. Coaches can see how each group performs offensively or defensively or excels in special situations. For example, if you need to force a late game turnover, you can see which group has the best defensive turnover percentage or see which four athletes work best with your star player. And you can do the same team-based analysis for groups of two or three players as well. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Discover how Hoopsalytics can help you make better data-driven coaching decisions. Visit hoopsalytics.com today to learn more.
Mike, welcome to the basketball podcast.
Good to be back.
Good to be back. Great to have you. And yeah, it's been a few years, but I've followed you and you've been up to some cool things, obviously, at Arkansas and now in the WNBA. And Coach, maybe let's start there. How was that transition from college to pro?
Great timing. There's a lot of things going on in college coaching that I quite frankly suck at. Good timing to make the jump into the WNBA and learn some new things, go back to being an assistant and relearn, get around a new style, a new pace, just all kinds of new things. I felt like a rookie all over. So it was great. The years at Arkansas were amazing. 8 years at my alma mater were life-changing, will always be home for me. May never work there again, may never live there again. But all those days were valuable. So many great memories. But it's been a fun transition. I've really enjoyed it. When most people that are going to watch this, I know I'm a learner. I want to learn everything I can and then share it. So I've never been very good at being in one place at one time. The change was good.
And that's why I thought this is great for us to have you on, because you were in an incredible late learning phase, no doubt. Transitioning to the pro game, being an assistant coach again, all those different things that come with that, working with Coach Roberts, and then your future staff, which we'll talk about with the Dallas Wings. But Coach, let's start with assistant coaching. You were a successful head coach for so long. You certainly had your views of how to manage a staff. I'm curious if anything changed for you from being an assistant coach again? And also, what are some of the best practices maybe you would share with coaches about the ways to be able to work with your coaching staff?
Boy, great question. And something I think we can all pitch in and learn from. I've evolved over the years, having been with the various head coaches. I was with some great head coaches, from Kathy McConnell Miller to Susie Gardner to Kevin McGuff to Gary Blair, all those people. And then also their staffs that they had been around. So the transition from assistant coach to head coach was a huge jump. Made tons and tons of mistakes, which I learned from. But I've learned those, just as many mistakes going back, like you just said, from being the head coach back to the assistant coach. So I think some things I'll continue to do. A few things, standard practices and best operating practices. One thing I would always do with my staffs, Chris, is I gave them a card, an index card. And on the front of them, I would tell them to write down five things they wanted to do. Five things they wanted to be heavily involved in. In fact, maybe even be the head coach of. And then on the back of that, five things you don't want to do. I don't know that. I'm sure somebody told me to do it or I read it somewhere. I can't give that person credit. I know it wasn't my own idea, but it became something that I really believed in. Because what happened over the years, all the different assistants I had, it was amazing how many times I would have assigned somebody something because I thought that's what they wanted to do. And in fact, they wanted nothing to do with it. In all my years with all the different staffs I've had, I never had to give anybody a job or a responsibility or a duty or a head coaching area that they didn't want to do. And if I can stay off your list of five things that you don't want to do, even if I can't give you all five of the things you want to do, man, that's a pretty good day.
It's a great day.
And it's a great day.
Yeah, I'm curious with that part of it, Coach. Just let's stay there for a second. So there's got to be a fine line there too with that, them not doing it, but also you mentoring them to help them get better at some of these things that they potentially have to do or find people to do it for them when they become a head coach.
Yeah, and here's what you run into. Sometimes you have some people that don't want to be a head coach. So like the financial part of it, some of the things are like, hey, I would only have to do that if I were a head coach, and I don't want to be a head coach. So, you know, anybody, again, that knows and has heard, I've got this wise pawpaw, and he said, you can fit a round peg in a square hole or vice versa. It just has to be a really big hole. So you're leaving so many gaps when you do that. But yeah, if that person wanted to be a head coach and they were consciously neglecting some of those areas, I would go to them and say, hey, you need to do one or two of these over a period of time. Maybe not this year, but you've got to start incorporating speaking in public. I had an assistant coach who was petrified of speaking in public. And that's okay, because there was no desire there to be a head coach. Okay, fine. But then if somebody said, hey, I really want to be a head coach, you're going to get better at that. So it is a fine line, but I think you put them in those roles when they're ready for them. One thing I learned from working for Coach Blair specifically, and then again for Kevin McGuff, was to never have your staff. It's best if you can have them at different parts of their career. Like, you don't want four people that are trying to be the next head coach at every job that comes open. That's a dangerous place to live. You might want somebody that's ready and somebody that's on their way to being ready, and maybe somebody that's not sure where they want to. So I always tried to balance staffs that way, to where I didn't have five people. If I got a call from an AD, they said, hey, we're looking at your staff and we want to hire them, who do you recommend? I didn't want to have to have them competing. Part of that came because I did lose my entire staff that year after the Final Four. Adia got the head coaching job at Arizona. Fred gets the job at Eastern Michigan. Morgan Valley was offered numerous jobs. So I almost lost my entire staff following that year. It's funny, when you don't win, nobody calls. But when you win, they call everybody. It's kind of how funny how that way it works. But
it makes sense to me, obviously, like not wanting to be a head coach, especially nowadays. You're seeing a lot of head coaches transition into assistant coaching roles because of what you said earlier, which is they don't want to deal with all the other stuff necessarily, or it's not their strength, which is also some humility that comes with that. But what is a trend in the WNBA is the transition from college head coach to professional head coach. Yeah. Fernandez, Coach Semesco, obviously Coach Roberts. Yeah. Talk to us about that and some of the things that kind of eye-opened for you.
I think for me personally, I won't speak for them. I've talked to all of them, obviously worked with Lynn and about to go work with Jose, and know Carl very well. I think the one thing we all have in common was what we just said. Some of the things that were going on in college, again, I think they're all great. I think everybody should be paid. I think we got to get some rules about it. We got to get some things underlined. But I think all of us were in it for a different reason. Now, I also think that obviously the popularity of the WNBA on the rise was what transitioned some of that too. For the last 25 years, maybe the college job was viewed as being the better of the two jobs. And I don't know that's happening anymore. I think with where the league is going, with where it could potentially go in the future, I think we're all pretty excited about that. So it is a really fast-paced, the level of play is obviously the best on the planet. And I think that's what all four of us have in common. We always just wanted to coach at the best level that we were prepared for. That's what I've said about me. They would have to talk about themselves. But when I was a first-year coach, I didn't want to be a college coach because I knew I wasn't ready to be a college head coach. Just let me be a good high school coach. And then after I thought I was a good high school coach, which I probably never was, but I thought I was, now maybe we'll try some college and be an assistant. I didn't rush that. It took me 14 years being very patient to find the right job. I just always wanted to coach at the highest level I was prepared for. And I think the WNBA and the highest levels, if you're in the SEC and the Big 12 and the ACC and some of those, the haves, that's really high level basketball. But I think where the WNBA is headed now and worldwide, I think it's a really cool, fun place to live. I've only got 6 months of experience, so I'm not going to sit here and act like I have all the answers to any of it. But I found that first year very enjoyable, and I'm looking forward to year two.
Another thing that it highlights is just being able to sustain a career in coaching in general. And you've been in the game for 30 years, so like you've sustained a career. And I keep emphasizing this to young coaches, and obviously I've gone an alternative route, but I've still sustained a career somewhat in basketball and coaching. But it's a hard thing to do, isn't it?
It's very hard. Yeah, it's hard to win a game too. Everybody's, oh, this person's record is this. I'm like, try to win a game. much less X number of games. I've always said too, a person's record is not the best way to judge their success. Not all records are created equal. Look at schedules and who they've played and all things like that, but not to birdwalk onto that point. Yeah, just having a job the next year in coaching. And I think obviously with the way all of society is nowadays, it's just hard to stay particularly in one place for very long. But yeah, just it was very humbling for me when I lost my job at Arkansas. It was my dream job. And even after an 8-year run where we were the highest winning SEC team in school history, it still wasn't the right fit at the right time. But when the phone started ringing that very day, it was like, okay, we've done this the right way. I had friends calling within hours of saying, hey, come join me literally this week. Come now. Come down here right now and go with us to this tournament. Go do this. Get in the film room with us. That was the moment where I knew that through sharing and building relationships and trying to do it the right way, not that I've done it the right way with everybody, every step of the way, I've made my share of mistakes, but I've shared with enough people. I've invested in enough people to where when that call came that I didn't get to be the coach at Arkansas anymore, I had a number of opportunities. Very grateful that the one came from Coach Roberts in the WNBA. I was sitting around waiting, looking through college jobs. None of them really at that point in time matched up the investment with what I was wanting to do. But when Coach Roberts called and Reagan Peebly, the GM called, that was perfect timing. And now that I've been in it for one season, it makes me want to have more. So yeah, like you're saying, you find ways to stay involved in the game and those numbers keep going up. I think this will be the 80th team I've coached this year in all sports. And at 57, those 80 teams, I have memories of all 79 of them. So yeah, we're very lucky to get to call this a profession.
Well, that's incredible. And I referenced your success at Arkansas, like historically one of the best 8-year stretch in the history of the program. Yeah. So it's just the realities of different places and different locations. And we won't go down that rabbit hole, but it's beautiful stuff. And, you know, I know you're doing TV and you're doing all this stuff. You're just such a great contributor to the game. So we're so grateful for you. And you referenced pace, and that's where I wanted to go, because okay, I think last time we were together, we talked about fast break and pace and the different things that come with it. And I know it's now not just the pro game, but the whole game in general, pace has gone up, and the Sparks led the WNBA in pace. So talk to us a little bit about some of your lessons that you can share with coaches about pace and the mindset of that.
Yeah, it's not an all out quest to be that. It happens as a result of the little things that you do. I've always said, let's function as fast as we can. Coach Roberts is in that same mode. That's why I think we did lead that. Plus the players we had drafted to that and built the team around it. But I feel like it's the best way to play if you can do it without turning the ball over and still take good shots. You can't just run up and down the floor and take the first shot that comes along. You can't turn it over. But I think no matter how long the shot clock is, whether there is one or it's down to 24 seconds, I think taking that first good shot by one of your top players at one spot that they've worked on, I think that's what it is. And I think it's also the beginning of your defense. That's where I start talking about that. It's if you take a great shot, your transition defense is going to be way better than if you turn it over or take a bad shot. That's statistically proven at any level. So everybody always pigeonholes me into being this all about pace, all about offense, when actually that's not the case at all. It impacts both sides of the ball. If you can quickly attack a non-setup defense where the help is occupied either with getting back or finding their matchup or trying to create, there are no matchups in transition. We all say that. I think it's the hardest thing to defend is transition. You're in it the most, no question. Most teams don't give up 50% from the field and add in turnovers. You're in transition more often than you're in half court. So I just always felt like that. It was a slow build. I played for a defensive-minded high school coach. So it was a slow build over the years, and it was a round of golf with Paul Westhead in a very randomly set up deal in which he called me Michael all the time. He said, Michael, son, he goes, do you like practicing all that stuff or would you rather practice this way? And I thought, man, that was pretty genius because you practice way more than you play. And I also think this, Chris, I also think you have to be able to do that to beat the best teams. I don't think, and again, I'm speaking specifically in women's basketball, college women's basketball, and I think even in the pros. You have to be able to score it when you get down to the toughest competition on your schedule. If you can't find a way to score, defense travels, defense wins championships. That all makes great bumper stickers and t-shirts, but sometimes there's not any analytics to back it up. I think you have to be good. There's a threshold that you have to achieve, but until somebody can convince me otherwise, I think trying to get the best shot as quickly as you possibly can without turning that thing over. That's why we reduce turnover some. We shoot it before we turn it over. Sometimes we've never scored on a turnover, but we scored on a bad shot before. So I'm probably going to die on that hill, and y'all put me in a box before you change my mind on that.
I agree. And I'm glad you said that part. Like, we do adhere to some old cliches in coaching sometimes, but the reality is definitely pace and scoring. And as you reference, it's what players want, especially if we're talking about the developmental levels, high school on through up. That's what helps get them that next level. So it's beautiful in that way too. And you reference pace versus protection. So when should a fast team tap the brakes?
When they start turning it over, taking a bad shot. It's that simple. I'm not going to overcomplicate that. Now, you have to have a lot of systems in place, a lot of checks and balances, and how you're going to determine who can take certain kinds of shots, what you're going to tolerate. I don't know who said it, but it was a great coach that said you're either coaching it or tolerating it. But the very second that we take consistently bad shots or we're consistently turning it over, that's the red sign. That's the red stoplight. We got to slow down. You need to look over here. We need to call. I need to take a timeout. We need to run a set. We need to walk it up. We need to use a little bit of the shot clock. I need to be able to help dictate who's going to get the best chance at getting this shot. I think it was Fran Priscilla that said there's nothing worse than a confident bad shooter. So I think you've got to be very, and I'm maniacal in the teams that I've been a part of, and making sure that our best players who work at it take the most game-like shots in a game over the course of a year. Now, that may not be true for a game. It may not be true for a two-game span. But if we look at a stat sheet at the end of the year on any team, you know, that I have any influence over, if our best players weren't getting the most attempts and the most free throw opportunities, then I've done something wrong. We've done something wrong. And to do that, you've got to value the other players' roles, and you've got to do a really good job of telling the story with that. But I think to answer your question, we're turning it over consistently and we're taking poor shots. However we're defining that, we define them very specifically, who, what, when, and where, and how. And we are maniacal in our defense of how that's going to go. And that's a hard lesson. That's a hard conversation. It's really hard at the pro level. I'm glad I'm not a head coach yet, because I don't know that I have an answer for that. Because it is, after you determine minutes, the next thing, shots, distribution, and the type of usage, I think, is the term that I learned this year. That's a rate that a lot of people are following when it comes to that. But I think it's fair. I'm glad that exists. I'm glad that the technology is out there these days for players to have access to that, because I think it's my job. Our job as coaches is to put our teams in the best places to win. And to me, that's making sure our best offensive players get the most opportunities to do what they do.
And going hand in hand with that, by the way, coaches, green light shooting, coach is famous for that one. So go look that up or listen to our last podcast. But brilliant stuff in terms of what he just talked about at other levels. But talking specifically maybe about the LA Sparks a little bit, because what went hand in pace is the number one paint attack. So getting great spacing and being able to attack, and obviously elite players, certainly Kelsey Plum, being able to drive and spray, that helps. But talk about some of the characteristics of spacing and the different things that led to a number one paint attack.
Yeah, it starts with De'Aaron Hamby when you're talking specifically about the Sparks. You got to have somebody to rim run. You can have great pushers of the ball, but if you don't have a big, we call them rabbits. If I'm in charge of them, we didn't call it there, but I call them rabbits because I want them out running. But we had it at Washington, Katie Collier. We had it at Arkansas with Taylor Thomas, with Kiara Williams, with a bunch of people over the years. We turned Dungy into a rabbit at some point in time as well. You're only going to be as fast as somebody that's going to put pressure on the rim. And we put pressure on the corners by running shooters out there, but you got to have somebody putting pressure on the rim with either with the ball or with the rim run. For us, we had the perfect setup for that. You had an elite decision-making guard in Plum. You had an elite rim runner, maybe one of the best I've ever seen, not only at speed, but relentlessly punishing her opponent, her matchup, every possession, just running at the rim. And if she didn't get it, she knew what to do after that. So I think those things have to go. And then you got to have some rules about where you're going to pass it, who you're going to pass it to, when you're going to pass it to them. to cut down on some of those turnovers. And then, you know, that next phase of that is, how do you flow? If you don't score in the first 3 to 5 seconds or seven, do you have to bring it back out to the top and set it up, or can you flow right into something? And that was for players like Rekia Jackson. And we had a Belgian point guard in Julie Aleman, who I think had she not been injured earlier in the year, we would have made the playoffs. It was obviously once she and Cam.
I think she led the league in assist to turnover, for example.
Yeah, yeah. She was crazy efficient. And then when Cam Brink came back, now you've really gotten two back-to-back elite runners. And we had a stretch for Azaree Stevens that had an unbelievable year with shooting the ball. So you've obviously got to have the personnel to do it, but I've always felt like you can do it with about any matchup, any aggregate of team you might inherit or live in your school district if you're a high school coach. I think it's a way that you can play. There's lots of great offenses. There's lots of great ways to win it. There's all kinds of ways you can go out there and do it, but they all usually require certain pieces. I told you I'm doing some TV now, and I caught myself the other night. I almost said, I hate when people say it's a chess match, because basketball's never chess, because we all have the same pieces and we don't move one at a time, and you don't go and then I don't go and you don't go and then I go. I understand the analogy, but it's more like poker. The great author Annie Duke talked about that with us one time on a Zoom back in during COVID. But there's so many different moving pieces. And I feel if I were dropped on any school district in the United States and I didn't have control over who my players are going to be, I think it's the best way to play, no matter where you're dropped, no matter who your players are. I think you can fit it to that. I think you can find a role for 8 players to 10 players. To fill and be successful, beat the best teams on your schedule. You're going to lose a game or two. I caution people of this all the time. If you're going to play this way, you're going to lose a game or two that you probably, quote, shouldn't lose. There's going to be another. Everybody, I can't believe they lost to them. And I'm all for that. I'm ready. I'm willing to trade that for that moment when you go, wait, they beat UConn? Wait, they beat South Carolina? Wait, they beat Maryland? Wait. I would trade all the upsets for those wait what's on the other side. It doesn't make for a glowing overall record, and you do have to answer some questions sometimes. But I've always been told to try to practice every day like you're trying to beat the best team on your schedule. That's why we don't press, because I don't think you can press the best teams. I think there's a reason you don't see a lot of teams pressing in the Final Fours and the Elite Eights. It can get you to the second weekend. It might get you to the first round of the playoffs, but I don't think you see teams doing that beyond. You know, you certainly don't see a lot of teams doing it in the gold medal round of the Olympics. So let's practice every single day. Let's do what we're going to do against Central Connecticut State, the exact same thing we're going to do against Connecticut. Let's not deviate our standards of play based on our opponent. And if you do it that way, you might get to coach someplace for 8 years. It may not be a quick turnaround. I don't know. I may not be equipped to come in and be able to build a team. I think you can build rosters in a year, but it's really hard to build teams in a year. And I think a lot of great coaches are figuring that out.
And such great points. And obviously, you've referenced Hamby already. And one thing that's curious to me is, like, in the pro game, playing out of the short role is such a superpower, isn't it? Like, yeah. Some of these skilled players get that ball in the short roll, and it just makes such a difference for the game. It's a little harder to execute at other levels just because of the skill of certain players. Yeah. But is that something that you took away watching and appreciating that?
Yes. Yeah. And because of the way people are going to defend the ball screens, they're going to try to get it out of great ball handlers' hands, and you're going to have to be able to throw it to the short roll player. And the teams that have that were elite. The teams that have that player that they can punish you in that area, spraying it out, taking it to score, getting fouled, hitting the shot. It's vital. It's vital. And that was a big transition. I don't think at the collegiate level, and certainly down to the high school level, it happens as much, because that pass is incredibly hard to make. I love all the CLA stuff that's out. I've studied it. I've defended it. I've watched it. It's sweeping the nation. I understand all that. But that is an incredibly hard pass to make at lower levels. Some of those cut passes. I know the percentages for cut layups. I know all of those things, but it can also lead to some turnovers. So having that person, I think you're seeing development to that role. That's a new thing in the last 4 or 5 years, that a player who might not be able to shoot the three or might not be able to drive it by can play in that area. with the ball in their hands and make the right decision at the right time with those other pieces out there. And I do think the higher levels you go, you get to where there's a really good dear friend who will end up watching this. He'll know I'm referencing. Most teams have a weak antelope. We would always make a killing out of finding the weak antelope, but the higher, whether it's the bottom of your high school league to the top of your high school league, to the best team in your state, to the whatever, the weak antelopes go away. I think that's a fun thing, fun way to play. I learned a lot this year with our skill development people, watching them teach players like De'Erica and Cam and even Rakia in that area, making reads and the decisions there. It is a weapon at the middle of the floor with two defenders a lot of times coming in chase. It's hard to defend. I did a lot of defensive work this year, and I hated playing against teams that had Neko Wumake is a master at that short roll. So I hated having to defend teams that had good players in that area.
You've been around so many good players and some all-timers. And one question, and this isn't about a specific player, but you can certainly think of some references. How did you define the non-negotiables for a scorer that has an unshakable belief in themselves? To the point that it's, we want them shooting and we want them to have that confidence, but sometimes those shots that I know as coaches were like, come on now.
Yeah, I think when a player gets the green light, so let's just call them the green light, whoever, we had to change the standards over the years on what a green light shooter was from gym to gym. It changes with every team. I actually, on some of these drills, there's always three levels. There's a green light standard, our current team standard, and then there's the plum standard. Hers was just, I couldn't compare everybody else. But I think once you get to that green light level, it's not necessarily the quantity, it's the types. Let's eliminate the shots that nobody in the world's making for a while. And that's where it comes, not the distribution, but the selection and the timing of it. You just took four shots in a row that nobody on the planet's making more than two of. Nobody. So the feedback's got to be immediate nowadays, Chris. You cannot wait the next day to the film room. We have evolved as a technological species to where we demand 3 seconds or less for a satellite to beam to outer space and get back to our link that we've clicked on. The players are the same way. You can't wait till the film room. You got to have it immediately. So I think finding that, and you don't have to have a lot of fancy technology to do it. You can do it with a cell phone. You can record it and show it to them when they're in those modes. Just helping the scorers through those moments where maybe there is a three or four shot in a row miss or not where you go to for 14. It's the actionable feedback that you give that says, this is why it's happened. Not that it happened. This is why it happened. You took this shot off the dribble that you were more open on the catch than you were when you dribbled it. So let's diagnose it. Let's give them tangible, actionable feedback, immediate feedback before the next day, before they leave the gym, so that they've got it fresh. If you let them walk out the gym, good luck getting them back. These days, we're going to watch the film tomorrow, gone. I think as a team, I think you can do those individually with players, but I think they've got to be short. I think they've got to be to the point and they've got to be something they can correct. So once a player got greenlit, that became our conversations with each of them. And I'm not talking about Plumlee. I'm talking about Chelsea Dungy in this case. This was a kid who had all the shots. She had the three, she had the drive. She could go left. She could go right. She could pull up. She had the mid range, get to the foul line. That was always her thing. If she was, quote, in a slump in her mind, it had nothing to do with mechanics. It was all about the type of shot she was getting. And then it was on me as a coach to realize, hey, she's on the verge of this. Let's run an action that's going to get her taking a different type of shot. And I think that's where you have to, as a coach, know when to go to the reins and when to go to the whip a little bit with those players. And you can with the greats. I think it's those unsure, the ones that don't know where they're going, the yellow lights and the red lights. I can coach. The yellow lights are the hardest to coach. Red lights are the easiest to coach. Green lights are the next. But the yellow lights are the hardest ones. The ones that think they ought to be green and they don't think they're red. That's an area where I think sometimes shoot, don't shoot does come in. I never want a green light shooter thinking that don't shooting is the option, not to take a shot that's been there. Over the course of now going on 25 years of it, there's only been an exception or two to that rule that I wish I would have coached differently.
Yeah, of course, the analytics have helped us all frame it a little bit better for players because, again, we're not telling them not to shoot. We want them to be more efficient so they actually score more, which actually helps them in the end. So I love that answer.
Hey, Coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to Basketball Immersion's group memberships. It's affordable and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams, get started now. Basketball Immersion Group membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast.
Coach, you talked a little bit about flow with pace. So talk to us about some of the different sequencing, chaining of actions, conceptual basketball, some of the different triggers that you like now after experiencing it at both college and WNBA.
This hasn't changed since I was in high school. I'm fascinated by football coaches. I am just fascinated. I've had a chance to be in the room with a couple of guys, Rick Jones being one of them that's at Missouri now. He was a high school coach at the time, and I used to drive a couple hours just to sit and listen to him and watch how he organized and how he put plays together. And it became, we call them triads. I've just kind of got this little triangular triad that's on a piece of paper that I have. And it's in my head now that if this action worked, then I know it leads to this action. And if that action works, it goes here. If it doesn't work, it goes here. And it just builds this, it looks like something you would see on the TV show Lost. It looked like the Dharma. It just kept getting bigger and bigger. But there, I think of things in triads, three trips in a row. Most of the time in basketball, you don't go down back very often. So I started looking at things in threes. If this play works, then it probably leads to this action. I call them plays, please. It's not a set play. It's actions we're putting them in. And if it didn't work because the defense defended it this way, so I need to take off in this direction. So the best teams that we had where we were really clicking, it's our 2016 Final Four team. It's our 2021 Arkansas team that didn't really get to play because the 20 COVID year and then the 21 year that was in the bubble, those were our best teams. If you go back and you're watching those films, those were the teams that could do this. That if Amber Ramirez was on, I knew a triad of plays to run for her. If it was Slocum or if it was Dungy or Michaela Daniels was having one of her nights. When those types of things started happening, I think as a coach, you have to be able to think like football coaches play. Not every play is designed to go for a touchdown in football. It's just not. It's designed to get 3 yards and set the next play up. And then that play gets 8 yards. And then as a result, then the next play gets your touchdown. So that's how I've always thought of things conceptually, offensively. And some of the stuff I'm back to sharing on some of the social media stuff is you can't look at a play. You have to look at those triads, and this leads to that. And if the defense defended it this way, then you have to call this action. That takes a lot of language, terminology that is specific to your team. And it takes a lot of reps, which all end in shots, and hopefully 2 or 3 shots. I think that's fun stuff to coach, and you have to have the players that can execute it. If you don't have the players that can execute it, it doesn't matter what you think is going to work. You have to give them the best chance. And I think that's one thing that Coach Roberts and I really agreed upon when it came to talking about the things we were doing was, are our best players consistently taking shots that we've worked on in practice that they are good at, staying away from their coach to their bright spots. And then you mentioned the analytics that are all out there. There's so many out there now. It's overwhelming for me. And I'm a numbers guy, and I still get overwhelmed by some of them. But you find the ones you latch onto, and paint points is always. Paint punctures was what I would refer to them as. How many times are we puncturing the paint with the pass or the dribble or the drive or the post up? I would still bet with all the analytics that go around, the teams that do that the most usually have some success.
Love that. And offensive rebounding. Where are you now on offensive rebounding? Because I know like the pro game, it's really starting to move towards getting back into offensive rebounding, tagging ups, moved into the NBA a little bit. Talk to us about your philosophy now with that after the pro game experience.
Probably still not. I wouldn't make any conclusions. There's not enough evidence in my mind to support a conclusion yet. It's a quote from the movie Hunt for Red October. Sorry, I digress. I still think it's important for sure. And I think if you have a team that can do it, then I think you should emphasize it. But I still feel like taking away transition from your opponents is, no matter what level, no matter what the shot clock is, no matter anything, not giving up points in transition has got to be a key. It's the easy answer, and it's one of those it depends type things. It depends on how good you are at it. If you can offensive rebound and still stop transition, by all means do it. I think officiating has allowed more aggressiveness and has rewarded aggressiveness on the glass. But if it begins to even enter into affecting your transition defense, then I'm going to pull back a little bit. I did learn at the WNBA level, if you get wedged underneath a player toward the baseline side, trying to offensive rebound, we're cooked. We're cooked because it comes at you so fast and they're so good at making you wrong. So you cannot under any circumstances get wedged to the baseline. That became something I looked for on film and wanted to make sure we were either even with or on top of to at least give ourselves a chance. But the second you get wedged under, the faster the ball moves up the floor and the worse we were in transition defense. And that, so many bad things happen when you give up transition attack. You get in foul trouble, you give up open shots, you're not set. It builds frustration in your players. It becomes less coachable when they become frustrated. I would encourage it to the point that it does not affect your transition defense. That's my 10-word answer.
Yep, good answer. Practicing less. Out of necessity, but I think in college we've gotten smarter, high school we've gotten smarter, that workload management, understanding our athletes, we want them at their best peak shape to be able to play mentally and physically. But it's out of necessity in the pro game that you just don't practice as much. So what did you learn from that kind of helps you be a better coach and be more efficient?
Yeah, you don't waste 1 second. Every drill's got to be a combo drill. You don't have drills. You have to have combos and you have to be working on multiple things. You don't ever do a shooting drill that just gets one shot and has four passers. You don't want to line anywhere. You don't do anything that's wasteful. I didn't even do that with our college teams back when at Washington. We didn't practice much. And I just heard Kurt Cignetti say something yesterday about how he's never practiced 25 times in the spring. He never has 15 in the fall. That was music to my ears because I believe in that wholeheartedly. So I think it's just more on us as coaches to make sure our practice time or our prep time, whatever you want to call it, this has been my rule of thumb ever since I started. If we're going to practice for an hour, it's going to take me 2 to 3 hours to put that plan together. If we're going to practice for 2 hours, it's going to take me 6 hours because it's valuable to players, especially at the pro level. Their time, they're looking to invest their time. You can't waste one single second. The second you do, your credit is gone. I felt like my credit score was getting checked every single day around these players in a good way. If you walk in there unprepared or you walk in there and you've got something just to fill a 4-minute practice plan, man, it's not received very well. So I tried to do that as a college coach. I wasn't near as good at it. If I go back to that, I'll be better at it. But not wasting 1 second on something that's not going to correlate directly to on-court success. You have to find a way for it to – now, break down the difference between prep and practice too. They can do their skill work. They can do their practice. They can do their prep a lot of different times, a lot of different ways. But when you've got your full squad and their full attention and you're all together, it better have a purpose and you better have it thought out down to the where everybody's coming in off the lines. You better be able to explain it quickly because one wasted second, and that's true at college. If you go to any of the highest, high of the high level, you go to a Vic Schaefer practice at Texas, that there's not one wasted second. If you go to a Eric Musselman practice, wherever he's coaching, I've never seen anything like it. I saw it for a few years together at Arkansas, and then I went this year at USC to watch him. It's never going to change with him. I have never seen a team do more in a set, let's say an hour, however long they go. Everybody's got their own nuances and their own twist on things and own ways to do it. But I do think that when you get a gym full of inspired. That was the other thing I learned about at the pro level. You don't have to motivate any of these players. They're already motivated. You have to now inspire them. And those are two different words. And I think that's what you have to do with your great players at the high school level or the college level or wherever, whatever level you're at. If your great players have to be motivated, you're already in trouble. But then you as a coach have to turn your attention to know I'm going to have to motivate these five or six, but I've got to inspire this one or two. And that comes from how you run your practice, what you do in your practice, how you chart it, and then how it relates to them when it comes game time. Is that stuff transferable? And if it's not, you're wasting time.
You're speaking my language on that. Definitely always up my wheelhouse. Let's get to the point and make sure it works and make sure it transfers to the game and helps them be better and those different things.
It's hard. It takes time. And that's where I think experience comes in. We all want to look the part. We all want the practice to look good. I've always said some of the most chaotic practices we ever had were our best. And we would get a lot of requests over the years from people. Can I come watch practice? I'd say, you can. I'm not going to tell you can't, but you're not going to get it. You might not understand exactly what we're trying. Let's just come to the office and let's go talk all about what you want to talk about. Because we're not going to probably do a drill that you want to take back to your junior high team or to your high school team, because you don't have a gym full of inspired kids. And you can't do this. You can't do this particular segment of our practice unless you've got 12 motivated and inspired kids. So I think we call it the curse of the clinic. You've been around it. You've done a number of them. We've done the same ones together. You can't do everything that those folks do because you don't have the same pieces. And that's where I come back to my chess and my poker piece. We don't all have the same. So that's what's great about clinics. You take what you can do, but you've got to take that back and make it your own. If you don't make it your own, it's not going to fit your team. And every team is different. That's why it's not chess. It's poker. We're all dealt different hands. And you can win with a 7-deuce offsuit if you can get those other three cards to come in and be 2 more 7s or 2 more 2s. You can still win. You can beat other hands, play in a lot of different ways in basketball. And I think that's why I like coaching basketball other than I love baseball. Baseball is my favorite sport. Most people don't know that. But you can't – it's not poker. It's more chess-like. It's move this piece, move that, throw this pitch. I like the fast-paced action that – and you have to play both sides of the ball, and there's no huddle in between. And that's what I love about the sport over some other sports that are also great in their own rights. But I just prefer the basketball pace.
We just had Clayton Thompson from the LA Dodgers on the podcast, Integrated awesome. Sports Science, and he talked about baseball and basketball together, and you would enjoy it because he talked a lot about shooting and the biomechanics of the two, so connecting your baseball love there. But coach, defensively, what from the pro game, tactically, technique-wise, what are some things that really stood out for you that can help us as coaches evolve and improve?
Yeah, you can't do things one way. As much as we'd like to say we're going to do this every time on a ball screen, the offenses have gotten too sophisticated. Skill development. If you go to watch a skill development session, it's 99% offense, 1% defense. So your defense needs to be, I think Lewis Horton, who was a junior college coach in our area, said it the best. Offense is art and defense is science. You have to have a scientific plan that can be adjusted. But at the end of the day, if you can't guard the ball, you just can't defend. I don't care what you do, man, zone, short closeout, chop your feet, slide into it, lunge. It does not matter if you can't guard the ball. Not guarding the ball sets up. And again, it's because it's what we're trying to seek on offense. I've always tried to do the exact same thing, opposite on defense. If we're trying to create advantages, which is all offense is, create the advantage, keep the advantage, punish the advantage. That's the offensive three-word answer. The opposite should be the same. Don't give up an advantage. Stay between your man and the ball. Don't let that thing puncture the paint. Force an extra pass. And this was the big thing for me at the pro level was let's not discourage the other team from making a mistake. Like, we would run at bad shooters. Like, somebody we had said, because, again, you've been taught to contest, and that's a closeout. Not on her. Not on him. Let's not get in the way of the other team screwing this up. You know, if they're willing to do that, let's let them. The big jump for me, and because you asked the question, I'll give it to you, was just knowing that at the – and I think this is true back to our kind of our hierarchy of levels. The higher level you go, you're only talking about making a 1-2 possession impact defense. Can you force them to do one or two things over the course of each period or half that they don't want to do or they can't do or they're not good at? So I think it has to be scientific. I think you have to spend an absorbent amount of time preparing to know what those things are that you're willing to give up. And then just coach your team to those standards. You can't be upset. If you're going to front the post and you're going to give up offensive rebounds, you can't be mad at both those things. if you're going to come off on the ball side, you're going to give up some corner threes. If you don't come off the ball side, you're going to give up some basket attacks. Be comfortable giving up what you're okay with. And then as a coach, don't react to those things that you've set them up for. And I think that's an alignment thing. You've got to be perfectly aligned with what you're communicating to your team that you're willing for them. And I don't want to ever use the term give up, but let the other team do. We're willing to let the other team and this player specifically do this. And they might make three tonight and we might lose tonight. Fine. But if we play them four times or the best of seven, we're not going to lose. You know, I know you don't get that chance in college. It's a one game deal and you have to go what's best. But like I have learned to be very versatile, be ready to pivot in whatever direction. I also learned to listen to our players because I would have a really good plan and I'd walk out there and then our veterans would get over there and go, hey, we're going to go blah, 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 blah. And by the way, they were right. So listen to your – they're the ones that are going to have to do it. I would watch all this film and I would say, hey, I think it's going to be better. And I'd look at one of our players and they'd go, okay, we're going to do this. I just think you have to have that relationship with your players because they're the ones that are going to have to guard them. They're the ones that are going to have to try to fight through that screen. They're the ones that are going to have to try to recover back to the short roll that you're talking about. Are we going to full rotate it? Are we going to leave them open? Just be comfortable and explain it so well that it can't be misunderstood that this is what we're willing to have happen. And if they make the shot, so be it. Judge the effort and not the result. Don't judge whether the shot goes in. Judge whether that was a shot we were willing to give up. Death shots. We had some labeled death shots and let them take some of those death shots. Don't do anything to discourage her from shooting it from right there. That's a 31% shot for her. It's a 24% shot. If you run at her, now she's dumping it to a 70% shooter on the cut. So I think defense is a little bit more scientific. I think offense is a little bit more artful.
Love the phrasing of that. And I know it's all, and coach, I know already, it's not going to be one thing probably, but let's say one thing. If you went back and coached college now, what would be one thing you took from this WNBA experience that would have changed or helped you?
Yeah, that feedback loop. Yeah. Just the whole change of the feedback loop. Because I think the elite high school, college, whatever, I think they crave that too. I wouldn't have a film session the next day. I would say, hey, I need to see you. Hey, we got to talk before you get out of here. If you want to go get your ice bath or whatever, do not leave this gym. That'll be something that I will never change. I think I'll ask more questions as well. I think I'll be less autocratic and more democratic. I think I will talk to them, make sure I have an understanding of what is happening. They're your best resource on the floor. I got away from that probably, that overcoming the curse of knowledge that all of us coaches eventually get to at some point in time. I know I will be better at those two things, making sure the feedback loop is closed down to the shortest amount of possible time. I may have to send it to them later that night before they go to sleep, but I'm not doing it. We're not going to have a film session the next day. I can tell you that. Then the other part will be, I'm just going to continue to, we tried to do this, but I'll be better at it. Just give them the full picture more often. I think it's so easy to get so narrow focused these days. I want us to be narrow focused on game time, but I want us to have context. I want us to have perception about every single thing. Because I think the things that they're facing in their off the court life with social media, with the pressures, the added pressure of the money at the college game has changed drastically. There are a number of people who are making money off these players. And that means there's three or four more opinions that they're having to listen to. I think I will do a better job of protecting them from those voices and make sure that they're hearing our voices, our staff's voices, what we expect, our voices. We'll get further away from goals than ever. Again, we could do another whole hour on the difference of standards over goals, but standards more so than ever. And then just shrink the things that we care about. We will not care about near the number of things I used to care about when it came to our collegiate teams and the good high school teams I coach too. Shrink those things down to a very few things on things you're going to care about. Things you're going to be willing to enforce. If you're not willing to defend them and protect them, then you should get rid of them. If you're not going to address poor shot selection, then stop talking about it. If you're not going to address not boxing out, then stop talking about it. Just keep it really simple. but then be maniacal in your defense of those beliefs. Believe as many true things as you can. And that takes a lot of information. You need the analytics. You need the film. Get all the information as a coach. Shrink that out of their world. Get it down to a few manageable things that are actionable that you can give them feedback on easily, quickly, and then they can take that and transfer it to the floor.
Maybe just a clarification, but do you mean in terms of the like giving them a constant reminder of the big picture in terms of this is where we're going? You may not be there yet, but this is what you're working towards, and that's where we're going. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, where we are, where we're at, where you've been. How you got to know where you've been, know where you're at, then you got to know where you're at to know where you're going. That little continuing thing. I think I will do those check-ins. I used to do them after every off day. That was my, hey, after an off day, we're going to do, hey, this is where we've been. This is where we are. This is where we're going. And that was sometimes a 5 or 6 day span between off days. I don't think I'm going to let that much time elapse. I think it may be a daily thing. Hey, here's where we're at yesterday. If we're truly going to try to be a little bit better, 1% or 2% or whatever the catchphrase is this year, whatever book we're writing, whoever's reading, we got to be better than we were. But we've got to do that today. But we also have a picture of where we're going and how it impacts. And when I'm doing this TV thing now, and we were in this great discussion the other day, we started to do power rankings for teams. And I was having a discussion with a couple other people that were doing it, and ours were drastically different. Our power rankings were drastically different. They were like, you have a team 7th in the league that's currently 5th in the country. And I did. And I'm going to tell you, it was Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt was the number 5 team in the country, and I had them number 7 in our league. And the reason was because I looked at their schedule ahead. And I think that if things go like they had, they might be our 7th seed in our tournament, which, by the way, is still good enough to host in the NCAA tournament and good enough to make the Final Four.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to have a 7 beside their name. When you start ranking things, and I get crap all the time from people who talk to me about my movie rankings and all that. When you start having to put a number beside something, man, you get to 7 pretty quick in a 16-team league. And if you're talking about movies, man, you get to number 500 pretty quick, and it's still a damn good movie, but it's number 500. I think I'll do a better job of telling stories to our players and letting them have some context and some pictures that, yeah, guys, we're striving to be number 1. We really are. But if we end up 4th or 5th, just to take a little pressure off some of these, and I'm going to keep calling them, I get in trouble sometimes at the higher level calling these players kids, but college players and high school players are still kids, and they have unbelievable amounts of pressure on them. And the amounts of money that some of these people who are still legally kids, it adds pressure because it adds people to their environment that they are trying to please. I will try to alleviate pressure. I want to continue to pay them as much as they can possibly make. I'm all for that. Two things can be true at the same time with this. I believe we should pay these players as much as we could possibly pay them. I really do. Now, I don't know what that amount is, but I think we've also got to prepare them for what to do with it once they have it and how to manage not just the money, but the emotions that come attached to that. And that's, we've all given them the classes. Every place I was at, we'd bring somebody in, give them a money market manager and give them these business plans. And I'd hand everybody a copy of Millionaire Next Door so they could start investing. But we didn't talk to them about the emotions that come attached to that. Okay. Now everybody views you as a pro. And because you're making money, they think they can talk to you and treat you and demean you in manners and ways that you're not prepared to be handling at 16, 17, 18. So I'll do a better job protecting my players. I'll be more vehement. I would let stuff go probably too much. I will not allow that to happen with our teams if I go back. And seeing these professional players having to go through, they're in the middle of we're in a crossroads with women's basketball right now. Maybe one of the most important times that we've had since I've been alive in the 30 years I've been a part of it, with what's going to happen in the next few weeks and months with the WNBA. So capitalize on the momentum that our pioneers have fought for, achieved, and then make sure we keep this game moving forward so it's good for all of us. So like you just said, so we can keep having jobs in this profession for another few years. I got a 4- to 5-year-old, Chris. I got to keep doing this. I can't ride off into the sunset like everybody else can. I got to keep finding a way to keep basketball important.
I sense you wouldn't stop anyways, Coach, because you love it so much. So talk to us real quick about the transition to the Dallas Wings and working with Coach Fernandez, who's done the podcast as well, coaches, for those that want a little reference on his background and philosophy.
Yeah, we've been friends for a lot of different reasons. We've served on many WBCA committees for years, trying to help the game continue to grow with the best we could. We've developed a friendship, and then I've known Coach, I still call him Coach Kurt Miller, who's the GM there, back to his Bowling Green days and his Indiana days. Just a chance to learn from them. You know? And then you see the excitement with the roster that's going to be there. That's going to be a tremendous learning experience. And I ordered 4 notebooks yesterday, ready to fill up with things I'm going to learn this year, I know. So I'm anxious to get it started. We won't get going until training camp, but it's going to be a fun time, I know, because it's people I trust, people I respect, people that have done it for a long time in women's basketball. We don't have the core group of people that have chosen to be in women's basketball, not because of any other reason that we chose to be around that sport and be a part of it for the last, I think we were saying the other day, between just the 3 or 4 of us that were on that call, there was like 120 years of women's basketball experience. We remember when the league started. We remember when it was not traveling. It was traveling on commercial flights and staying in hotels, in airports some nights. I hear horror stories. I'm very fortunate to not have to have done that. I feel bad that I didn't experience the pioneer part that some of these people have put forth to grow the game. But I'm looking forward to learning, and I know I'm going to learn a ton.
Just like we have from you over the years, we super appreciate you, Coach. You're just a great share of the game. And coaches, you can catch Coach Neighbors on TV doing SEC broadcasts. And
I don't recommend that. Unless you have a low def. If you have a high definition TV, please turn it back to low def, or try to find the non-HD.
To criticize your rankings, Coach. They want to tune in.
They can do that. They can do that on Twitter. Please check us out on X or whatever, my LinkedIn or whatever, wherever those things go. But I don't recommend any. The worst part is, Chris, it plays the last show of the night, replays from 11 p.m. to 3 a.m. And I've got texts from people that have woken up in the middle of the night with the TV on and seen me on the big screen, 85-inch TV. Nobody needs to be seeing that. But, yeah, it's fun. It's fun to get on there and talk about just – watch basketball wherever you can. Get out, support it. I think our game needs support more than ever. We've got the casual observer they're at a tipping point right now. Are we going to keep watching this? Are we going to keep supporting collegiate athletics, high school athletics? The trickle down's happening. There's still so much good going on. And don't get caught up in the 2 or 3 bad stories or the loudest stories that are out there. Man, there are still so many great stories out there of coaches, players, teams doing it the right way and for the right reasons. And I just don't want a few negative stories, bad information. What do the kids call it? False information or fake news. That's it. Don't let the fake news drag you down and into a place where you can't go out and find it. There's a good high school game around the corner or a good college game right around the corner too. You can go support.
I love it. Appreciate you. Thanks for sharing with us, Coach.
You bet, man. Appreciate the opportunity.